OG ready. He turns on the rubber, the 2-2 home. Swing and a miss, he struck him out. The 2013 Red Sox are the world champions and Boston strong.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Bedlam at Fenway Park as the Red Sox clinch the World Series at Fenway for the first time in 95 years. From last to best, the Red Sox have won their third world championship in 10 years.
Well, it's interesting how the name kind of, in a way, hurts the case in some instances because, like, you know, I saw you guys did the Monster Quest show. It's like, this isn't really a monster. It's just got the name Monster, but we're talking about more of a straight-up sort of UFO encounter without a creature that we know of, right?
Right, right. And what happened is, where I jumped off tractor a few minutes ago, is when Mrs. May, Jean Lemon, and Stewart went to New York, they sat down with a sketch artist. And Lemon and Mrs. May are trying to describe this thing. Now, you know, these people live in central West Virginia. There was only like one or two cars up in the whole area, and Stewart owned one of them. And then there was the police car. These people basically lived off the land. It was a poor area. And even when I started going up there in the early 90s, Tim, it kind of looked the same way as it did back then once you get into those backwoods. But eventually the McDonald's, Kentucky Fried Chickens, and Dairy Queen start all popping up there. And right now, it's you wouldn't even recognize it. But I was lucky enough back then to have videotaped the whole area before everything got built up.
Yeah,
and I have video footage of that farm before it got bought out and turned into a dude ranch, and it's all beautiful now. But I have the original shots from the early 90s and the tree that had decayed and fallen apart.
Yeah. Now, can people – so it sounds like you can't just go there anymore and check it out.
No, they actually have guards up there on the property now.
You'd think they'd some enterprising soul would have opened it up to –
Yeah, there was a doctor owns the property, and he works with us well if we have to get up there to do a TV show. But, you know, I can't blame the guy. You don't want people tromping around your property going up there. We've done some different little get-togethers where we had access to go up onto the property. But back to the drawing, Tim, is the sketch artist sat down with Mrs. May and Lemon, and Stewart was in the background kind of overseeing this whole thing. And he's like, okay, what did this thing look like? And these people are trying to describe this structure that looks like nothing they had ever seen, or anybody for that reason that
I know of,
have never seen anything like this. And they're trying to describe this thing, and the sketch artist is doing this picture, and Mrs. May's trying to describe the lower torso to this thing. And how she's trying to describe this, they're actually pipes that are running around a lower circumference. They're vertical pipes. That was part of the exhaust. That's where the gas was shooting out. It was a hovercraft, and that's why the thing lifted. The original drawing shows a representation of the drop cast shadow, and that is correct because if you look at the original picture, you see it floating in the shadow underneath that was representing this thing's off the ground. But what Mrs. May was trying to get across to this guy, and it just missed, she was trying to describe these big pipes around the lower torso, and they reminded her of the drapes hanging in her living room.
Right. I was going to say, it looks like something wearing a dress or a
librarian. which were rolled. When I talked with Kathleen, she told me, no, it was metallic. It wasn't cloth, but she was trying to give something, you know, as close to what she could recognize this as. And when I was working with Freddie and doing all the thumbnails and comprehensive sketches, I remember sitting in his living room in Gassaway, and he said what Mother was trying to describe were pipes. And he held his arm out, and he said they were about as thick as my arm, my forearm. He said, and they were metallic too. And he said they went around the whole lower circumference. He said they were about as thick as a fireman's hose, and they were all spaced equally around the lower portion. from the waist up, this thing had actually tapered to the shoulders. On location at the site, Freddie actually took me step by step. We started out at the school playground, and some of this can be seen on the YouTube interview. And we went from the school playground up to Depot Street, up to the house, and we walked the exact path step by step with my cameras. And I videotaped them along the way. That's how I was able to tighten this whole timeline up and series of events of what happened.
Right.
Was because Freddie walked with me, actually several times. And Freddie stood on site where the tree was, where he saw his mother and Gene and the older boys up front. And he said this thing was about 4 feet across at the base. And it tapered. And at the shoulder area, it was about 3 feet wide. Now, what the original sketch artist had drawn is like this hooded cape thing going over the top that looked like an ace of spades. Freddie said it wasn't a hood. And Kathleen told me also, they said it was an outer helmet.
Hmm, yeah.
And the face of the monster was not a face. It was an inner helmet. And the head actually sat on this collar that was a couple inches high, so it was actually rotating around almost like a crystal ball sitting on a pedestal. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm looking at the picture from your book, and our good buddy Alfred Lemberg has posted a picture also in the chat room of it. So,
oh, cool.
Yeah, so folks listening live can follow along.
And Freddie and Kathleen both told me about the size of the eyes. Now, they weren't eyes. What Freddie really was adamant about, he said, Frank, he said they were portholes. The press reported them as eyes and bloodshot eyes, and the story just got carried away.
Right, right, started getting more and more.
The whole thing was a joke. But they were portholes, and when Mrs. May and Gene had hit this thing with the beams of light, it lit up. And one of the first times I interviewed Kathleen, I said, so did this thing actually react to you like it was intelligently controlled?
Right, I was just going to ask you that, yeah.
And Mrs. May said, yes, it responded to me. The second we hit that thing with the beams, it lit up from the inside. Now, what happened is, there were beams of light that were actually forced out of the portholes. They weren't laser beams, you know. They weren't Buck Rogers laser beams that shot out.
It was like light came up inside and
forced light came out of it. And one time, Freddie told me, he says, kind of is like looking at a car, all the lights inside your car at night, how they come out. You know, the dashboard displays and the digital. He says it kind of lit up like that from the inside. And these beams, they were actually weak. They went over the tops of their heads because this thing was twice the size of them. And one of the times up there I interviewed Freddie, he said, looking at this thing, you could tell from the reflections, he said there was like a plate glass window in front of it. There was like a facade that was attached to the helmet with this helmet, the outer helmet with the inner helmet. And it was kind of looking like at a fighter pilot sitting in the cockpit of his jet.
Mm. Now, do you
wearing
think,
his helmet.
Based on all your research, do you think this was sort of like an escape pod or maybe a beacon to call for help with people inside? What's your sort of take on what this, for lack of a better term, craft was?
Yeah, it was like a miniature hovercraft. Freddie told me that this thing, to him, was like a spacesuit. He said, Frank, this thing was a spacesuit. It was some type of a small mobile craft, and from what Mrs. May said, this thing reacted to her. Freddie believed that there was possibly something inside of it that was controlling this thing.
Yeah, like maybe the thing was the main craft was damaged, so they kind of want to get out of there and figure out what to do.
And that's
and they can't just walk around on Earth because they're presumably from another world.
It's a hovercraft. And, you know, then we go back to what had happened 6 weeks prior is when we had the where the Air Force had admitted with the flying saucers. This is the year of the saucers, summer of the saucers. They were seen just about every day over the United States. If you can't talk them down, shoot them down.
Right. That's how this all connects. That's the amazing
right.
stuff. Before we get to that, I just want to give you kudos. First of all, my style of show is when we get something really compelling like this, I just step back and let the expert go. And I got to give you credit, though, man, because I know without your work, this thing would have been lost to the sands of time, this whole story, you know.
And it's amazing, too, Tim, because the answers are all out there.
Yeah.
It just took, it took 20 years of my life. It ate it up, but it was, it's interesting. I would do it over again, but everything is out there. I had no idea how big this story was back then. I read in a couple places it was estimated. Now, Flatwoods is a town of 300 people back then. Right now, there's about 400 there. It's a little community.
That's tiny, yeah.
There was approximately a guesstimate within 4 to 6 weeks after 10,000 people went there.
Oh, my God.
That's a lot of people. And Mrs. May was getting phone calls 24 hours a day from around the world.
Well, you got to give dubious credit then, I guess, to the powers that be, because if not, like I said, if not for you, this story would have been lost to the sands of time. So they did a pretty good job of, smothering the story.
Oh, absolutely. It's unbelievable. Intelligence was up there. They actually went up there. They were all, undercover. They were incognito. And I used a lot of Donald Kehoe's original quotes from his investigation of looking into the case. He did more of a governmental his research was into
right.
that, and from the higher up, from the big boys in the Pentagon and a blue book right down. And he talks in his works how he was told through his sources at the Pentagon that there was a couple guys up there who posed as reporters. And then when I interviewed Mrs. May, she told me, and she never read Keogh's book. She didn't even know who Donald Kehoe was.
Yeah, yeah.
She didn't know who Ed Ruppelt was. That's, like way beyond. They had no idea how much this was covered. And at one point when I showed Mrs. May my 2-pound book with Project Blue Book,
yeah,
and I flipped open a page and I told her about how CHOP had, the Pentagon had told Kehoe, it was probably an owl in a tree and all of that kind of crazy stuff. Mrs. May got upset, and she was really disappointed because she didn't know all of this stuff. And I said, Kathleen, this was heavily documented, and look at this. And it was called a meteor. The craft is called a meteor. And what I did is I worked outside of the Flatwoods area in my research, and I just kept expanding like concentric circles.
Yeah.
Flatwoods was the bullseye. I kept expanding out, Tim. And I eventually found 116 locations throughout the United States where these things had flown and crash-landed. There was 4 damaged crafts that came in over the United States that night.
That night?
That night. And the majority of them were within a short time, within about a half an hour. And they crash-landed through the whole United States. I pinpointed every single location.
My God.
And documented every location. If you go on to flatwoodsmonster.com, you could see the master map that I worked with, and you could see the flight path trajectories. And I worked with different people over the years. I didn't do this on my own. I didn't figure all of this out on my own. I don't have a military background. But by working with military people, I've worked with retired sheriffs and deputy sheriffs and cops and military people, we figured this whole thing out. And what it basically was a search and rescue mission.
Yeah.
These things came in looking for it. And the cool part about it is, Tim, the majority of the documentation was right in Project Blue Book, and nobody saw it. It was hidden in plain sight. And
nobody saw it from the research community, presumably, but the powers that be probably kind of figured out what was going on.
Yeah, and I don't even know if they know.
That's true. Yeah,
because
they might
there
be
was so much going
like,
on. I think it would have taken them over 20 years to figure out what was going on. You know, because I actually went to Tennessee. There was a outside the Kingsport area in Arcadia. There was a UFO that had crashed down there, and I went into that area and documented that. There was three of them that came over the Eastern Seaboard. They were approximately 90 miles off the coast of the United States, and that is where the origin point was from. And one object had flown that was damaged. It flew down towards the southwest, and it was actually heading towards Oak Ridge National Laboratory, and it flew through the no-fly zone, Oak Ridge. The second one had flown in the other direction, and it headed northwest. And this object flew towards Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Oh, boy.
And it actually stopped short of Wright-Patt, turned and redirected, and landed up in the West Virginia Panhandle, and en route to going up there, nearly collided with two passenger planes.
My God.
So it's all documented. It's all pieced together. The third object, Tim, flew straight down the middle, and it flew over Washington, D.C. And along its flight path trajectory, when it hit over the Eastern Seaboard and came in over Washington, it was actually flying at certain points at treetop level with pieces flying off of it and exploding.
Jeez.
And as it flew over D.C., all of this documentation is right in Blue Book. I couldn't believe what I was reading.
So what does it say in Blue Book, that these, essentially what you're telling me, that these unknown craft were flying?
This thing came in, and it was called the Flame Over Washington. And it was actually reported on September 13th in the New York Times, called the Flame Over Washington. And when this object flew over D.C., this was about 7 o'clock. There's people out driving around in their cars and convertibles. There's people walking their kids in strollers, walking their dogs. They're walking around Washington area. And here comes this thing flying just about a treetop level across Washington. It was seen by hundreds of people. It wasn't a little isolated incident. Well, what happened is when this thing flew over Washington, headed west, there was a series of UFOs that ascended, descended into the area of Washington, Virginia, and Maryland. And these UFOs formed a perimeter, an aerial perimeter, as they descended down over those three states, and they followed it west.
Yeah.
They were blocking for it. It's all in Blue Book. The answers are right there. Nobody ever pieced it together. I actually did a handmade map that was about 8 feet wide by about 6 feet. And I got maps of Washington. I worked a lot over Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University here in Daytona. I live right down the street from it, by the racetrack. And I spent years going over to Riddle, getting maps out and working with different people. And
yeah, I'm looking at one of these maps on Paratopiary. It's amazing. It's
and
the detail involved. I gotta stop you here, man. I'm just amazed. You're dedicated to this stuff, to this case and this story. It's amazing.
So what these UFOs did is they followed the damaged one until it reached over west into the Virginia area, and there was actually a pilot in a plane that flew real close to this thing and saw this fiery object flying by over Front Royal, Virginia. Well, after this thing got outside of Washington, D.C., over Virginia, heading west, it took a half an hour for it. From the point it flew over Washington, it flew about 200 miles west. It hit northern Braxton County in a little community called Burnsville. When it hit Burnsville, it redirected and headed south. And that's where it flew all the way further, deeper into Braxton County until it hit the center of Flatwoods.
Yeah.
Turned, and it landed up on the hill. It's pinpointed all across the country. The other UFOs had ascended back up into the sky. They went into the northern panhandle area where the other one had went down. They dropped out of the sky, Tim, for 2 hours looking for the other one that went down.
Jeez.
And that is documented very heavily in the press. And the Flatwoods Monster case, all the articles did not appear right off of the bat the following day because the story went in too late. Hmm. When I started looking at the following day, the event happened on September 13th. When I started looking into the following day's reports, I have all of these different articles about UFO scene and fireballs and stuff crashing around the United States. And I'm like, this is nuts. So that's what you're seeing there is those 116 locations on that master map where the UFOs flew. And they actually flew into the Panhandle area, and they were flying and landing and touching down in the area of Pittsburgh, eastern Ohio, and that section up around Wheeling where the thing went down, and they were just dropping out of the sky for 2 hours. And the people were panicking.
I can imagine.
This is the summer of the saucers, and you have articles, you know, in that whole region up there talking about meteor showers. one of the objects in the Wheeling area actually touched down between the radio towers on top of a hill and landed and then ascended and took off again, just like a meteor would do.
Yeah, exactly. Now let's connect all this to the air war of 52, because that's what this is all about in a big way. You know, it sounds like the events of the Flatwood Monster case were sort of the pinnacle of this shoot them down spree, if you will, right?
Right.
So I guess, you know, now just bear with me, because we're going to have Alfred calling in a few moments. But,
okay.
You know, give me sort of a short thumbnail on this shoot down order. I mean, what have you uncovered on this, and how extensive was this? You know, how was this a one-off sort of thing? Was this a rare occurrence, or was this like an ongoing, frequent situation where pilots were encountering UFOs and trying to shoot
them? Like, when we talked right before we went on the air, there was something that really tipped it all off when I was starting to read through Ed Ruppelt's book,
mm-hmm.
The Report on Unidentifying Objects.
Right.
It came out in 1956, and there was another edition of it later. But it was documented, and I might as well read the quote straight out here instead of
mm-hmm.
just trying to edit it. This is what Ruppelt said in his book. Other assorted historians point out that normally the UFOs are peaceful. Gorman and Mantell, those are two other cases, just got too inquisitive. They just weren't ready to be observed closely. If the Air Force hadn't slapped down the security lid, these writers might have not reached this conclusion about being peaceful. There have been other and more lurid duels of death. Now, that's when the red flags went up. And I called Stanton Friedman up. I said, Stanton, you read this book. When's the last time you read it? And he said, it's been years. I said, do you remember this quote in there? And he says, not really. That was what we talked, what you played at the beginning of the show.
Mm-hmm.
So we started looking into this a little bit deeper. Stanton started looking into it. He started making phone calls and get connections. And, you know, before you know it, we have all of this data. And everything I could get my hands on. I have a massive UFO library with periodicals, newsletters. I have a storage unit filled with thousands of pieces, Tim.
Okay.
I don't have a couple. It's massive.
I can imagine.
I started going through this stuff, and I started pulling out different quotes and different people who had written about this over the years. And then I actually went over to a couple of local colleges here, and I started looking through the New York Times. I wanted to see if I can find anything else out about this quote. And I started finding all these articles about missing pilots. And to make a long story short, what I did in shoot them down, I went between 1951 and 56, and I wrote a chapter in there called The Six Deadly Years.
Yeah.
And between 51 and 56, the New York Times was chock full of all these mysterious disappearances and screwy-ass crashes with only interceptor jets. No mid-air collisions, no takeoffs, no landings. All of these things happened up in the air, and pilots were disappearing all over the United States. And during that time, that is when I kept looking further, and I found the International News Service report from Tuesday, July 29th, Air Force orders jet pilots to shoot down flying saucers if they refuse to land. And the quote is, Lieutenant Montsell Montz, information officer, stated, the jet pilots are and have been under orders to investigate unidentified objects and to shoot them down if they can't talk them down. And that's just one of them. I just came across another recent article. Pilots ordered to shoot down saucers in range. It's an International News Service story, and it's from the Charleston Gazette. We have the San Francisco Examiner in California. Jets on 24-hour alert to shoot down saucers. And the further I look into this, the more I'm finding. Then we're finding out all about all these missing pilots. And Kehoe was looking into this very in-depth back in the early 50s. And he's got a lot of quotes about it. So what I did is I pulled all of these quotes together. I pulled all my statistics together, and from my New York Times case study, which is, I basically started post-World War II and went all the way up to 1959. This took years to do, and 51 to 56 had the most accidents.
Yeah.
And according to the New York Times, there was 205 fighter aircraft accidents where interceptors were destroyed.
My God.
And that's just a fraction of what actually was occurring.
Yeah, that's just what we know about.
Right, that's just what was reported. And what I noticed is when all of these things were starting to happen, there would be big front page articles. Jets would mysteriously crash into towns and cities. And, I mean, people were getting killed. Little kids are in the backyard playing. It was horrible shit. The gasoline is spraying and burning little kids.
Oh, geez.
I mean, it's nutty. Just planes dropping out of the sky. And they were front page. Then as I started going on, as I got closer to 56, there was still a lot of stuff going on, but they would be stuck in the back of the underwear ad for Gimbals at the end of the paper.
Yeah.
And it would be like a two or three little liner. And I'm like, but it started out with these big articles, and then I started cross-referencing through all of my data and Blue Book. I mean, anything I could get my hands on, I was cross-referencing, and I had these massive charts and all my data together, and a lot of these locations where the jets were going down and vanishing, there were also flying saucers seen in the area. And this is what I put together. Since then, I have also been working on and what I call my master book. I put together a book, and it's called Duels of Death. And I have every single thing that happened to do with jets and UFOs documented for a 10-year period, Tim.
Michael.
And I have that book sitting on the back burner. The Shoot Them Down book is just 52. I cover a 10-year period from 47 to 57 of everything. It's a massive book.
That's amazing. Let me just jump in here because we got Alfred on the line. I've had him on
great.
For like 5 minutes, so I want to bring him in here. All right. Alfred, what's going on, buddy? We got you in on the conversation now.
Okay, real good. Do I have to turn off anything over here? I can just leave it the way it is. Are we cool?
I suppose so. If you got the show playing, you can shut it off in the background because now you're part of the show, so you don't need to listen. You're living the experience.
Hey, Al, how you doing? Loud and clear.
Pretty good, buddy. Yeah, Art Bell is always saying, turn off your radio, and I was wondering if I had to do that over here. Hey, real quick and dirty, because I know you guys want to get on with some other, you know, going back to the very beginning when the Flatwoods affair initially started to kick off and everything, it's been debunked and very religiously, vociferously, and nastily debunked by persons of the caliber of, say, Dr. Immaterial Joe Nichols, for instance, right? And they're and they're all very fond of you know, coming up with these different excuses of what it could have been, like a geological gas in the area because of the makeup and the coal stratas of West Virginia, this, that, and the other thing, and another one is seasonal plants that made the kids sick and made them see funny things, and then, you know, finally that last one, which was a demonstration that the people of Flatwoods, who had been living with the flora and fauna of that area for many hundreds of years, probably knew, you know, something about owls and what they're supposed to look like, you know.
Yeah.
So all of that is just all of the discussions about debunking the whole Flatwoods affair on those scores have been proven completely ridiculous. A MUFON star team. Geologists went up and checked out for the difficulty with the geology in the area, and gave it a clean bill of health. Said, you know, there's not the kind of necessary formation in that area that would make gas and what have you. But what we have to remember is that whatever occurred, whatever's true, it never happened before, and then it never happened again. So, you know, what's up with that? You know, there really had to be something going on up there. Frank talks about, you know, tracking the UFOs, and that he was very assiduous. And you see the picture of the map where the UFOs are tracked, and the listener might ask the question like, hey, you know, how do you do that? What's the function of tracking UFOs and putting them on the map and everything? And simply, all it was from named reports and official reports and Project Blue Book, you get time signatures, you get bona fide witnesses, first person witnesses who witness these things, and you were able to establish them to a timeline and see which way these aircraft are going and what have you. But I want to finish up here real quickly by saying that everybody needs to remember that and it's too easy to think that the Flatwoods affair might have been an isolated incident, that okay, it happened once to some kids and some people up there in the hills of West Virginia, and it doesn't, you know, account for much. But what everybody has to remember is that first we had the summer of saucers in June, July, and August. And the Summer of Saucers was the biggest UFO flap in United States history. On top of that, the United States government, I would assume, decides that they want one of those puppies, and they issue the military orders to shoot them down. And it's pretty much shoot on sight. There's a little codicil in there about, if we can't talk them down, then we'll have to shoot them down. No, all that's for the lawyers. Right. Yeah. All of that's for the lawyers. It was shoot them down. Now, following that, the shoot down orders, we have September 12th rolls around, where we have 21 and a half continuous hours of distressed UFOs flying around, landing, taking off, smoking, very acrid, smelly smokes, making sounds in the air like they're distressed. And then following that, you have Flatwoods, the end of the story. And none dare call it an undeclared secret war with E.T., but, you know, what's it sound like to you? Over to you, Frank.
Yeah, exactly. And,
yeah,
and
absolutely.
What's interesting about it, too, I'm not going to let you go just yet, Alfred, so let me know when you got a bail on me. But what's interesting, too, there is that, you know, you hear about the stories of the shoot. You know, I've always heard the shoot them down stuff, but I'd always thought that it was sort of a one-sided affair, that we couldn't handle the UFOs, and that's why we lost all these pilots. But based on what we're learning here tonight and what we've learned from Frank's research, that clearly we were getting our own shots in. We were winning small skirmishes, apparently, if there were these UFOs going down.
Yeah, and then when you throw into the mix what the United States had, but what the government had developed, was the F-94C Starfire. and that had the AR rockets, the Falling Fin Aerial Rockets. They were 2.75-inch rockets. They had a 7.5-pound warhead, and they were about 4 feet in length. They weighed about close to 20 pounds, and these babies traveled at 2,500 feet per second. And add that on to a jet flying, you know, over 600 miles an hour, which was about their capabilities back then. We also had the F-86D Sabre Dog, and that carried 24 rockets in a lower body in an elevator. It was, you know, it would lower down, it would fire the rockets out, and the Navy had the F-7U3 Cutlass, and that carried the rockets in a pod. We had the capability, and we were using them, chasing flying saucers and shooting at them with rockets. Now, that would have been a nice surprise to UFOs who were used to dodging bullets, because we were shooting at them. This is documented.
Yeah.
I have several cases pulled out and put aside. I could give them to you, but I'd have to dig through all my notes, where it's documented how they were chasing and firing at these UFOs. And this is all in Project Blue Book.
Yeah.
So what we have here is these three rocket-bearing jets chasing flying saucers and UFOs. These particular UFOs came in over the eastern seaboard. Three of them were damaged. I have even went to the extent where I have taken these different objects, and I figured out their flight paths and have the exact locations where they touched down. We had the one that went down in Tennessee, the one that flew over Baltimore and crash-landed up in the West Virginia Panhandle, the one that went over Washington and crash-landed in Flatwoods. Then we have one that came up from North Carolina. The one that came up from North Carolina and route from Florida actually crashed 4 times. The one over Washington crashed 2 times. The one that flew over Baltimore 5 times, and the Tennessee one crashed 2 times.
Jesus.
So we have 4 damaged objects where I pinpointed, along their flight path trajectories, 13 landings. I don't want to run through all of them now, what we also have, too, is when I told you earlier where these UFOs were dropping out of the sky for 2 hours up in the Pittsburgh, eastern Ohio, and Wheeling, West Virginia area. They called it a meteor shower. There were actually 8 landing sites where those things were touching down and dropping in people's backyards.
My God. And
searching where that one went down. There was one landing site in West Virginia, 6 in Ohio, and 1 in Pennsylvania. And that was the story I told you where one dropped down between the radio transmitter towers and then took off. These things were going on all over the place. And I was able to establish that there was 25 different UFOs seen, as Alfred mentioned, 21 hours plus of sustained sightings on September 12th, 25 different craft. And I was able to differentiate by using the Blue Book documents and from the tentative observers' witness questionnaires of what these things look like. They did drawings. Well, I did the same thing, except I put them into order. And there was all different shaped objects. There were saucers seen, the round-shaped objects, the ones that were jet-shaped objects, like cigar-shaped objects. And once you have a certain shaped craft and you see it over here, over Washington, then it's seen over Virginia, then it's seen here. And I tracked them going into Flatwoods. This was a massive search and rescue operation.
Now, Alfred, while I still have you here, you know, with the risk of embarrassing Frank for giving him too many kudos for his fine work, I think it's important to stress here the importance that there's still a lot of good information that we can dig out of these old cases, you know, as opposed to storming the gates of Congress in a futile attempt to get the government to reveal all of the UFO secrets. If we circle back and look at what information that we have available, clearly Frank has demonstrated that there is great stuff that can be gleaned from this information of the past that maybe people need to take a better look at, right?
In idle, casual readings, for instance, there is a much divested and completely discredited case called the Desvergers case. And roughly what we're talking about, you'll remember about the Boy Scout in Florida our Boy Scout leader in Florida who had a raft of Boy Scouts with him, and they're driving home, and they see something from the inside of the car, and he stops the car to run over the Boy Scout leader, Dismergers. What's his first name, Frank?
Yeah, the West Palm Beach story.
Right.
Yeah, West Palm Beach. Yeah, that was in August, just a few weeks before the Flatwoods case.
Yeah, but see, the point is that that case was discredited until Frank found it in Blue Book, inexplicably after it was completely destroyed and washed away, and found the link up with the Flatwoods affair, giving credibility to both cases, because you see, Dismergers case had interest from Blue Book the same way and in the exact same fashion that they did for the Flatwoods case. The only problem with the Dismergers case, the only problem with the Dismergers case, remember, is that Dismergers thought he saw occupants in the in the craft that he saw. So naturally, you know, during that time frame, they didn't touch reports like that where people were actually seeing beings.
Right, right. Yeah, but it's amazing that there's such good stuff still out there that people, that has fallen through to the sands of time, if not for the work of guys like Frank. So kudos to Frank.
Yeah.
Kudos
to you,
man.
Well, when you look, you find. And something
indeed,
else, too,
yeah.
Going back to Flatwoods for a second, there was a small mention of Colonel Dale Leavitt and what he had contributed to the affair and what was going on with him. And the reason I bring him up again is that Colonel Leavitt interviewed on tape, and you get his complete story. I mean, the guy was there, was a bona fide United States Army hero of the Second World War, right? And he took a pretty heavy battalion of people up there into the hills along about the September 12th time frame. The point being is that you don't move a unit of that size or any unit into an area, right, 180 guys based on a couple of kids seeing ghosts up in the hills. You know what I'm saying?
Right, exactly.
It's just all of it's so completely nuts. And so completely ignored when you have a situation where, and I don't mean this to belittle it at all, and it might sound like I'm getting ready to head off into that direction. I am not, but I'm talking about soldiers missing in action, just the way they were lost in Vietnam, just the way they're lost in Afghanistan, just the way they're lost in Iraq. Missing in action soldiers, guys that were ordered into dark, stormy skies to battle UFOs. It boggles the mind.
It really does. It's amazing that it happened. It's amazing that it's been covered up for so long. It's just absolutely remarkable. It's scary that they can get away with covering it up for so long. So.
Well, what I have here, what Alfred's talking about, and I'm just going to take a minute or so to run through this, Tim.
Okay, should we let Alfred go? You want to head out, Alfred?
No, it'd be cool if Alfred hangs out, because he's the one that brought this point up.
Okay, we got you.
What I found in the New York Times is I was going through, I found the different veteran combat fighters, and I found that there was 9 cases right off the bat where these veteran combat fighters disappeared into thin air or they crashed under mysterious circumstances. I'm going to run by from the top to the bottom how many combat missions these guys had.
Mm-hmm.
One had 182, one had 130, 105, 100, 185, 81, 70, and 32. Now, those are the top 9 guys, as reported in the New York Times. That's 9 guys who died, total 885 combat missions. That was between World War II and Korea. Some of them fought in both. 885 between 9 guys, and they vanished into thin air or they crashed under bullshit circumstances. All of this was covered up. And in a majority of these cases, we have UFOs and saucers seen in the same area. That's what I was able to piece together. And out of that crew there, we have 4 aces. One was a World War II ace. Then we have another World War II ace, a World War II ace, and we have a Korean ace who had 10 MiGs and 328 combat hours. These guys are just disappearing in a thin air and crashing. It was unbelievable.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's a couple hundred of these cases. And when you look further into it, and yeah, it would take a lifetime. There was thousands of these.
It's amazing. I mean, we've gone an hour and 50 minutes, and I feel like we've only scratched the surface on both of these stories. So I've already told Alfred off the air, we're going to, the three of us are going to do a taped conversation sometime in the future to continue this. Because mm-hmm. there's so much to talk about. It's really, it's just mind-boggling, as you said, the breadth of this, this wave of this secret war. It really was a secret war. It's amazing. Yeah,
and it's all documented. It's all documented.
Yeah. In the not only in the Blue Book archives, but also in your in Shoot Them Down, right?
Right, right. And it's also been documented going back into the early works of Donald Keough and Stringfield. Those guys had touched on it. They started the ball rolling. And I have all of their old books and they're all of their works. And that's what kind of put it together. But the Lurid Duels of Death quote by Ruppelt is what really triggered this off.
Yeah, Lurid Duels of Death. That's,
there have been other more and Lurid Duels of Death.
That's a vivid language. Mm-hmm. Alfred, the website for you is alienview.net, right, buddy?
Yes, and from there you can find alienview.blogspot.com, I believe. Yeah, yeah.
There you go. All right.
At any rate, well, yeah.
Well, we're right up against the end here, so thank you, Alfred, for calling in and joining in. Like I said, we're going to do a longer version of this triumvirate. Of folks talking, me, you, and Frank. So,
looking forward to it, Tim, and we'll see you later, Frank.
Okay, thanks, Al. Have a good night.
Out here. Have a good night, buddy. Now, Frank, tell me a little bit about what you have coming up. I didn't mean, as I said to Alfred here on the private chat, wasn't trying to boot him. I was kind of keeping an eye out on his phone bill. I don't.
Yeah, right.
And as I said, yeah, we're right up against the. We're getting close to the hour here. So what's the time frame, I guess, on the book, this master book that you're working on?
Well, the book is basically finished. And I just finished putting out the expanded version of the Braxton County Monster. So I have that under wraps. And last month I flew out to Hollywood and I was interviewed for the movie 701 the Movie. That's mm-hmm. a docudrama that's going to be released in the spring of next year. So I went out to Hollywood for a few days and I was interviewed and I met a bunch of the key players, Fox and Torme and Inez Romero. And from what I understand, there was over 40 people interviewed. And from what I was told, this is probably going to be the best UFO documentary / docudrama ever made. They went to the end of the earth, and there were people there from all over the world that were flown in for this. Hmm. I came in towards the end. I was one of the last persons interviewed, and I did about a two-hour interview. And I may be going back out there because they're going to be doing a reenactment because this group of people is really on the ball. They right. want to get this thing right, unlike what the Monster Quest thing turned out to be.
Yeah, I don't even want to get into that. Next time we
yeah.
talk, we'll get into that because I watched a little bit of that on YouTube today, and that was a cluster F. So.
Yeah, and what happened with that is Alfred went up to West Virginia, and I basically got to handpick my team. And I picked Stanton Friedman. I got one of the guys from the star team out of Pennsylvania. John Bainbridge came in. And Stanton, we had everybody there. We had, like, a great team. We did our jobs. We did, I don't even know how many hours, a shoot. We were up in the mountains. We were going about 16, 18 hours a day. And I never heard another word. And they never worked with me after they did the shoot. And when I saw the finished product on TV. I saw it when everybody else did. I almost fell over.
Yeah.
I'm like, I can't believe they did this after the work we did. I actually was there in the studio with Alfred where we did the shoot, right after my interview. And the cutaway shots that you see during that show, during that same sequence, what we did, Tim, is they zoomed in, and I actually went step by step across my master map.
Nice.
And I showed everything of what happened, because the official government explanation for all of these sightings is it was a meteor. And I showed on a map, they never even used it. And that meteor was seen, the explanation through Blue Book was it was seen for, had an endurance of about 6 to 7 seconds.
Yeah.
Where when it flew over Washington, it took about a half an hour to fly to Flatwoods. It was over Washington about 7 o'clock and nearly 7:30. So it took a half an hour. The thing was flying about 400 miles an hour.
Jeez.
Not 26 miles per second. And that's what it was said to have flying. That meteor was going pretty quick.
Yeah.
It wasn't a meteor at all. And there was no meteor records anywhere on planet Earth about meteors or meteor showers on September 12, 52, except in Blue Book.
That's just unbelievable. It's unbelievable stuff. We're this is one of the downsides of the live show. We're running out of time. So I don't think I heard exactly when. What's your timetable on the master book with the 10-year?
I don't know. I just got this thing out of the way. You know, in California, and
I was
working with the people out there. So this is going to be my next focus. Is this book? Hopefully soon. Soon, Tim.
Nice.
We're
sounds good.
On it.
Yeah, I can imagine you probably want to catch your breath a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. It was a good trip, though. I'm impressed. You know, I kind of saw everything from the inside out there and for that California trip. And there's some impressive cases and some really cool people involved in this thing.
And where can folks get the new book, the Braxton County Monster updated and revised edition? Is that through Amazon or actually Lulu Shop? So just go to flatwoodsmonster.com. Right?
Yeah, go to flatwoodsmonster.com. And then if you actually, when you come down a few inches on there, you can actually see the YouTube piece that I put together. It's a 37-minute long documentary. And some of the key people that I interviewed, Mrs. May and Colonel Levitt and Freddie May, you'll actually see highlights of the actual interviews when I tape them. And it looks pretty good. It's a nice little piece.
Nice.
And that's a link right on the website, too. And the book, you can get the book there.
All right. It sounds like this thing continues to grow, continues to expand. You're getting more and more information. So I'm going to obviously, it took us way too long to get you on the show. And, you know, as I said, this is one of the rare times where we have the limitations of the live show, because I feel like we can keep talking for quite some time. And
yeah.
And we will do so in the future. We will definitely have you back on the show. I want to get you and Alfred together for a show together and talk about this as well.
We can keep going.
Oh, absolutely, man. Absolutely. I can't give you enough credit. I've just kind of stepped out of the way and just enjoyed listening to this stuff, because it was just amazing. I got to give you just huge props, Frank, for doing the legwork on this and dedicating so much time. I mean, if only we had more guys like you, we might have cracked this case a long time ago.
Yeah, and I've said it for years. If the UFO community stuck together as tight as the skeptics have, this thing would have been solved years ago. But, you know, the UFO community isn't as tight in a lot of aspects as you would think. Everybody's looking for the smoking gun. And instead of working together as team, you know, it's a shame.
Exactly.
If more people work together like the skeptics do, bashing everybody. Yeah, this thing would have been solved a long time ago. But I'm starting to see that happening. You know, a lot of the people are starting to work together.
Well,
Stan Friedman has been great working with me on this case.
Oh, Stan's the man. Stan is, you know, he's an icon. So
yeah, and guys like Alfred Lemberg, you know, hats off to Alfred. Alfred's been worth $1 million working on this project.
Absolutely.
And Alfred's been in Flatwood several times, and so is Stan.
All right, well, we're at 20 seconds left, so I got to say goodnight to the live audience. I'll include the plugs for Banal of America stuff after that. But on that note, thanks for tuning in, folks. We got a whole new episode coming at you next week. And until then, have a good one, folks. All right. The live audience is gone, but let me throw in the plugs here for Banal of America for the folks listening on the MP3s. You can find out more about BOA at banalofamerica.com, B-I-N-N-A-L-L of America.com. Check us out on Facebook. Just punch in Banal of America. And I want to give props and congratulations to Con Anderson. He was like number 1,099. Jeremy Bloxon was the long-awaited like number 1,100. And Scott Bringhurst just missed the cutoff there. He was like number 1,101. If you want to help out the program and keep us on the air, you can make donations via PayPal or our P.O. Box. All that information can be found at Banal of America. The next edition of the program will be coming at you on November 12th, 1 week from tonight. It will be a taped episode featuring Dr. Annie Kagan and Bill Guggenheim talking about after-death communication. I read the email from Mike and Ken about their outro song on the last episode and forgot to include it. So stay tuned in just a few moments and you'll hear the fancy outro song from Mike and Ken. And with all that said, thank you so much, folks, for tuning in. Thank you for your enduring support of Banal of America, and thank you for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.